Now recording. Did you want to introduce Dan, Dr. Picard, or did you want to introduce yourself, Dan? I don't know if you guys decided that.
Okay, let me introduce Dan. So, thanks everybody for joining this special event today. We've been very lucky to have some fantastic speakers this last few months, weeks. Dan is something absolutely phenomenal, which I wanted to have for a long time in this class. Wow, lots of people joining now. So Dan trained me for CISSP in 09, 08 and 09, actually. I had to do the training twice because I ended up in hospital the first year. Dan was very nice to allow me to join back in 09 when I was back up and functioning. So he is in Central Ohio. It's the biggest CISSP concentration of ISC square people, of CISSP people, I think, in the United States. Dan, I think I'm correct about this.
I think actually DC beats us out, but certainly on a per capita, it's just a massive concentration of InfoSec people here. And through a local great training program that's been running for 18 years now, twice a year, we've trained probably over 4,000 people in the CISSP locally. So it's great.
And I did take ISSA training with Dan and a bunch of other folks, and it's what helped me pass. It was a very good training. Dan is a CISSP, ISSCP. He has about 20 certifications in 09. I don't know how many you have now, but I do remember you had about 20 at that time. Sure, it's probably a little bit more now. Dan used
actually a few. They're very expensive to keep up, so.
Yeah, I'm dropping them out myself. I can't afford them anymore. So Dan is used to be a board member from ISC Square, which tells you a lot. I mean, you know, to be a board member, you need to get endorsed by 1,500 people. So he knows a lot of people, and you know, he was ISC Square board member for a while. He's actually running again for a board seat, I think, in the future, or he should be. So Dan, thank you for accepting my invite. Dr. Burton, thank you for helping to organize this. Dan, as we discussed, the topic is kind of yours. I think you want to talk about ethics because it's something that is not typically talked about. And with that said, feel free to start. And thank you for being here.
Sure, sure. And thank you for having me, giving this opportunity. I am passionate about ethics, and maybe that will come through as I get farther in. The obligatory "Who am I?" There. So you know, you can basically find most of this out via Google and LinkedIn. Although I will warn you that Dan Houser also is the same name as the creator of Grand Theft Auto, but he has a lot more money than I do. You know, I'm sure you can figure out which of us is which. Been doing InfoSec full time since 2000, and have quite a few hobbies that I enjoy. And certainly teaching is one of them. And I'm currently a senior information security manager running two teams for the American Chemical Society, which is our security engineering and our governance, risk, and compliance teams. And so if I were to drop out, and for those of you that are not familiar with Linux, Unix, you know, if I were to do a PWD, which basically shows what is the path to my working location, if I were to do that search, it would have started out with business consulting, restaurant management. Oddly enough, that was my first job out of college. Boy, that was long hours, lots of pain. I saw a lot of stainless steel and almost 100 hours every week. And was fortunate enough to get out of that and do some programming. Was then QA analyst full-time for Baby Bell. Did some consulting, programmer analyst, et cetera, et cetera. You guys can read. And then I got full-time in information security in 2000 and have been there ever since, doing certification and accreditation, was a security architect for a number of years, about 16 years total, as an enterprise security architect, identity architect, auth architect for JPMorgan Chase, and have done a lot of consulting on the side with fun stuff like social engineering, penetration testing, investigations, et cetera. So that's a bit about me and the strange trip that I had. Very few people go directly into information security. You typically start off in a different path and then make a sideways move. And this is my lateral move into information security. And I found it to be a very rewarding field, and I really enjoyed the profession. And that is something we'll be talking about tonight. So why this talk? I served for a number of years as either the chair, the co-chair, or a member of the ISC Squared Ethics Committee, a total of about 9 years, and was on the board of directors for 6 years. And the board of directors sits somewhat like the Supreme Court, that the ethics committee hears cases, renders opinions, and presents those recommendations to the board of directors. And the board of directors is the final court of appeal. So all told, a fairly long tenure looking at ethics cases. And it was my big surprise first day as a board member, you know, wet behind the ears, showing up, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And then hearing ethics cases was something I completely did not expect, and grew to really enjoy that. It was, I refer to my stint on the board of directors as the most rewarding and the hardest job I ever had, but it was incredibly rewarding. One of those reasons was because of ethics. Hit the wrong button, pardon me. And we recognized as the ethics committee that the profession didn't talk about this nearly as much as they should. So I worked with the ISC Squared to obfuscate some case studies, generate some realistic case studies while not violating anybody's privacy. And these are approved by the board for release. I have a few gentle edits, and I did add a fifth case study if we have time for that, but all errors certainly are mine. Overlapping concerns. I'm actually subject to, as I can see it, at least four codes of ethics. I am governed by the ISC Squared Code of Ethics and the Canon. I'm governed by my corporate ethics policy. I'm governed by Ohio ethics law, and then also the Ohio Criminal Code for Military Justice, because I'm a member of the Ohio National Guard Cyber Reserve. So I'm governed by four overlapping concerns. Fortunately, I've not found any of them to be in conflict as of yet. That might be interesting. But as a professional, you have to recognize that sometimes you are subject to multiple ethics policies and concerns. Why ethics are important. Information security professionals have a very high level of trust. There's the requirement for ethical behavior, both on the job and off the job. And that's what allows us to provide the assurance that we are actually worthy of that trust. I have said before, and will say again, that our only coin in information security are our ethics and that trust. And ISC security also sets and upholds a standard where the corporate ethics program originates by the CISO. And there's significant control and access that security professionals have. So good judgment and professional conduct is required. You have to lead by example and take the high ground. It's important as well to realize that as a security professional, you are a professional. And this wasn't really the case maybe 30 years ago. It was not actually recognized that information security was in fact its own profession. And it certainly is. It requires professional education, professional experience. There's a shared body of knowledge. There's special attainment and discipline that's required. There's responsibility and responsibility for the common good to my clients, my profession, and ahead of my personal interests. And I've had to say before, to some of my my employers, hey, I'm sorry, but I can't do that. That's against my ethics. And let me explain why. That there is a higher calling. The calling that an engineer has to society to make sure that the bridge doesn't collapse goes far ahead of the duties to the engineering firm or to the person that's paying for the bridge. You have to be willing to sign your work and take responsibility for the work of your subordinates, your colleagues, and your associates. These are the duties of a professional. But on top of that, You're not just a professional, you're also a security professional. A security professional layers on top of this with special authority, responsibility, and duties. I've had to do investigations of horrific things in my past. I've had to see some very sensitive information and have to weigh and sift this. Do I actually have evidence that something occurred or not? And have to be able to say, no, I don't. I have inferences. And I cannot say that this actually happened or this did not. And I can tell you what I know, and I can tell you what I believe, and I can tell you what I don't know. And use those words very carefully. And so you have to use the privileges and capabilities that are intended. Always good to not give unwarranted comfort or unnecessary alarm. This is one of the big ones. This really is very big. Good enough, close enough, think we'll be fine. Those kind of platitudes, is that based on actual knowledge? Or unnecessary alarm. This is a high risk because the vendor of my security tool says so. That's unnecessary alarm. So I have a particular duty to preserve confidentiality as well too of principal's data. We'll get into this more. This is one of the primary duties that comes up very often. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. And we have some particular ethical challenges in information security that maybe are unique. And some that are shared with other professions. So, challenges for misrepresentation of certifications and skills by some in the profession, perhaps abuse of privileges, the inappropriate monitoring. Are you monitoring too much? Are you monitoring more than you need? Withholding information that should be disclosed, right? That's the flip side of confidentiality. And it's important to understand that. Other ethical challenges is inappropriate divulging of information. Loose lips sink ships is that old saying from 50 plus years ago, and still a true concern that you have devastating losses from keeping your mouth open as opposed to shut. Overstating issues or controls, conflicts of interest, and particularly undisclosed conflicts of interest, and then the management of attorney-client privilege and attorney work product, and knowing who you can talk to, who's been read in, and who requires the attorney's opinion in order to speak to them. These are some of the concerns, but those are particular ones that are not necessarily unique to information security, but they do come up. I also point out the ISSA Code of Ethics. It's worth reviewing. It's a similar code of ethics and covers a lot of these bases that you have, accordance of all applicable laws and the highest ethical principles that you're promoting. Current best practices and standards. I don't like the phrase best practice. Standards of due care, I think, is a much better phrase. That you're maintaining the appropriate confidentiality that we said. And this is a direct quote from their website. I did provide the link at the bottom. This is not my rewording. These are their precise words for the ISSA Code of Ethics. That you will discharge your professional responsibilities with diligence and honesty. Refrain from activities that could constitute a conflict of interest or otherwise damage your reputation. And it goes on and on there. The challenge is refraining from any activities which might constitute a conflict of interest is a very high calling. I think the better way I might have phrased this, if they give me edit permissions, would be refraining from any activities which could create an undisclosed conflict of interest. Because sometimes you will have a conflict of interest that should be disclosed. And that doesn't necessarily mean you cannot act. It means that there may be areas in which you have to recuse yourself. And then to never intentionally injure or impugn the professional reputation or practice of colleagues, clients, or employers. And this is also part of the IEC Squared Code of Ethics. And as a CISSP, I need to subscribe to the Code of Ethics. I need to put the public good ahead of those of my principles, and those of my principles ahead of those of my colleagues, and all of those ahead of my own interests. And as a member of IEC Squared, I can refer to the guidelines, but I alone am responsible for interpreting those and recognizing as a professional that I have a duty and obligation to understand those and make those decisions and to seek sage counsel when I am faced with hard choices, which I've had to do a few times.
Dan, can I mention something for everybody? Be very careful. Everything that Dan mentions now, those ethics is a topic in the exam. You could very easily be asked a question about what is an ethical behavior for an ISC Square person. Mm-hmm. Don't underestimate it. Lots of people think ethics, well, you know, act ethical way and that's it. But there are actually questions on ethics in the exam.
Yes, yes. And we're getting ready to get into the chapter and verse on those. In fact, and I will not read this. You can get it off of the website. The certification is a privilege that is earned and must be maintained. It's not a one shot. It's something that maintained over time, must be earned every day, in fact. And ISIS crew members are obliged to follow the ethics complaint procedure. Now, we operate off of the Navy standard, not the Army standard, as I have my good friend Bill Murray, the inventor of information security audit, not the actor, just shares the name. And he phrases it that way because Army officers are compelled to report and naval officers are not compelled to report. There is not a compulsion to report an ethics violation, but there is the charge to act ethical and act in the best interest of society. And when those best interests of society are served by reporting, you must act. There are really only four mandatory canons in the code, and all the rest of it is the wrapping around it to help understand it. There's the preamble, much of the preamble of the Constitution, same kind of thing, framing it up. Here's what we're going to be talking about. And it talks about the safety and welfare of society, the common good, duty to principles to each other. It requires that we adhere and be seen to adhere to the highest ethical standards of behavior. Not that we're snobs, but the only coin we have in our realm is that of ethics and trust. And we need to make sure that we maintain that. And here's the actual code of ethics. Four short statements. This is it, right? There's a lot wrapped into this. You would not believe. Oh my gosh. You would not believe the tens of thousands of hours into every single word and exactly what goes where and everything. There's a lot of thought that goes into this. And the code is to protect society, the common good, the necessary public trust and confidence, and the infrastructure, pretty much in that order. And then to act honorably, honestly, justly, responsibly, and legally. And that is secondary to the first canon, that you must provide diligent and competent service to principals as the third, subject to the other two. And then to advance and protect the profession. One odd caveat there is people do not understand this. Giving away your services for free is not advancing and protecting the profession. And now, you know, I'm a charitable fellow myself and do donate services, but they get a bill in which I say I would have normally charged you $6,000, but I'm going to waive this pro bono on the basis that I believe in your charity. But if I make my work look free, I make it look trivial, like, you know, any bozo could do it. So that's one odd wrinkle to the canon that people don't quite understand, is there is an obligation to advance and protect the profession. And that also includes colleagues. The purpose of the ethics process, because there is a process behind this, is to protect the profession and society, to maintain that integrity and to protect the reputation and integrity of members via association. I normally do not like to read my slides, but I would not want to misparaphrase some of the important phrasing that are in the Code of Ethics. There are specific responsibilities under the code to subscribe to it. You need to be familiar with it. You need to be able to resolve any sort of conflicts. There's a requirement for professional development and to review and endorse applications and do that honestly and equitably, and also to report violations. It's not an obligation, but it is a responsibility that makes sure you do not violate your ethics by remaining silent. There is a control for due process. A whole surprise to me as a newly minted board member. And then it's like, oh, I guess I didn't know there was a complaint process. I did know that as a CISSP, and I have a few other ISC squared certs that I, you know, had to learn about that. And then I got to actually experience them on the inside. And there's an application process. Endorsements are reviewed, and sometimes people have to answer questions on there, like, have you ever been convicted of a felony or a non-traffic misdemeanor? Have you ever been decertified, disbarred, or faced other official sanctions? And those kinds of questions. Don't quote me on those. I'm going from memory here. But so there are there's a review of endorsements of those answers. Anybody answering yes, you know, I have a felony or something like that, automatically gets flagged to the ethics committee, gathering of information, let us know about that, et cetera, and that goes forward. And then that's reviewed by the committee. There is a complaint procedure where complaints can be lodged. There is then that process, that complaint is then weighed and sifted, and there's a committee recommendation. There is a potential possibility to appeal then. And the different attributes of that, as it steps through there is definitely confidentiality. There needs to be a specificity of the complaint. You know, Jerry's a bonehead is not specificity, right? Complaints about, I don't think they're qualified. I can't see how they ever could have passed the exam. That's gossiping and rumors and grumbling, and certainly not specific. There has to be a standing of the complaint. You have to be the one harmed, or at least you could say that society has been harmed. And then the format of the complaints in writing is a sworn affidavit where absolutely possible, because this could be evidence. There could be a lawsuit. And so it's not just a phone call and, you know, Jerry's being a jerk kind of thing, right? And forgive me if I happen to name your name. It's just picking them at random here. And the ethics committee is not an investigative body. You know, I think it was probably within the first year or two of the IC squared being around, they realized that the ethics committee could be used by one member to attack another, perhaps go after your competitor. It's a deliberative body. You have to present evidence, and they're not going to go off and hire a private investigator to, you know, chase you around with a camera or something insane like that, or you know, fly to Mongolia or Taiwan or wherever it may be in the world. I think the IC squared is in about 120 countries now, and there has to be sufficient evidence to support a prima facie case, right? It's not vague inferences, but on the face of it, there must be evidence. There's a right of respondents to know that they have been accused and to respond. There is then the weighing and sifting for disagreement on facts and a burden of proof. Not just seems fishy to me, not good enough. There are then findings and specific recommendations that are made in writing and provided. There is the notification of those findings and recommendations to the complainant and the complainee, and the right of comment to those, so that it's not a cabal, you know, hidden chamber. Here's what we found. Here's what we deliberated. If we miss some evidence, if there's any other thing you want to say, you know, now's the time to say it. And then there's ultimately the potential for disciplinary action, and then a final disposition. And as indicated earlier, there is an appeals process. So the scope of action, the IC squared cannot nor should not take action against somebody not in the membership. We cannot hold arbitrary people to the code of ethics who are not members. So the scope of action is limited only to members and candidates, and there are fairly limited sanctions. Largely there is censure available, sternly written memo, don't do this again, is probably the weakest possible sanction. And then there would be removal of certification, or in the case of an applicant, forbidding them from sitting for the certification for a period of time, and for, you know, come back in 5 years and show us how you've changed, or whatever that may be. Ultimately, banned for life is the highest possible sanction, although there could potentially be legal action if it actually harmed the association. So applicants is probably where most of the action happens on the ethics committee, which was a surprise to me as well, too. I figured there were, you know, all these complaints. So it's almost all applicants because the IAC squared has grown substantially over the years and has been quite successful. And there are all sorts of folks that would like to get their certification. And it's a booming field, and the pay is pretty good. So there are lots of folks looking to get in. And any ethical questions raised during the applicant process, and that is really, really different from an ethics complaint. A lot of that is frankly criminal activity. It spans the gamut right? From a few joints 25 years ago to a stream of DUIs, capital murder, arson, and pretty well everything in between. And then the ethics committee has to then find out, you know, is this somebody who will permit in? Because, you know, there's a huge difference in those cases I just provided, right? So that begs the question. And there are two, this is not canon. This is just illuminating questions, although the IC squared let me put this in their official slides. This is my opinion. These were two hooks on which I could hang opinions readily. Is this a person who is demonstrably devoid of ethics? Do they lack an ethical compass? Really hard to really know that, but if we're seeing a scofflaw with repeated offenses, you know, 5 DUIs in the last 3 years, this is a person who is endangering society. You might not have thought DUIs is something actionable, but it is endangering society and showing that you're not acting honorably and showing very poor judgment, and et cetera, et cetera. And is this someone with whom we would proudly shake their hand and call a colleague? There have been some incidents of harm against children, and you might say, well, you're a changed human being, but I can't quite get past the fact that 5 years ago you did these horrible things. So I don't think I can. And boy, are these hard decisions, really hard decisions. But you're trying to weigh and sift these things that may have been found as a violation against the Uniform Code of Military Justice, perhaps disbarred in a state, defrocked by some professional association. And then now what, right? That is quite a lot of what goes on. Any questions so far before I jump into case studies as we start actually wrestling with these things? Okay, if you have any, I do have the Q&A open, so feel free to go ahead and shoot me a question in the Q&A panel. So far no questions, so I'm gonna charge ahead. So case study. Okay, so
keep going.
All right. So case study one. I think I hit the wrong button. I already stole my thunder by jumping into 1A. There we go. So Amanda is a CSSLP, and she files a complaint. Brian is a CISSP. He's an independent consultant and was retained to perform a systems and network assessment to PCI DSS standards. She says, oh, it's slipshod. It just did not appropriately reflect the standards. He just didn't do a good job. It did not demonstrate an ethical amount of due care. We've reached the interactive portion of tonight's lecture, where we turn to this interaction stuff. So, hey, is this a case of ethics? Is what Brian did unethical? What do you all think? I keep bumping my mouse. Not good. All right. I'm going to fire up the chat and see if anybody's chatting about this right now. What do you think? Is this a case of ethics? Is what Brian did unethical? I mean, is there a cause of action? And what is the evidence? We have Amanda kind of grumbling.
How do you prove that? The question for me is, maybe it's slippery, but how do you prove it?
Yeah.
Client complains, unless the client says something. It may be true, but unprovable.
Yeah, and to prove it, you'd have to almost do another audit, and you'd have to also look at how the audit was performed. You know, auditors use sampling rates, and I have seen audits where they completely missed it, and I can't figure out how. But based on the sampling rate, they just didn't happen to pull the ones that were on fire. It happens, right? And it's not really what this is hard to have evidence. And the ethics committee is an investigatory body. They're not going to send out PCI auditors to do it themselves. This is a she said, he said at this point, not really actionable. So if you march forward and like, you know, it's, sorry, Amanda, we can't help you. She comes back and says, well, you know, actually, there's some further documentation. The real problem I have with what Brian did is he forged 3 signatures on the compliance documents, and the signatures do not match those of the principals. And Brian says, well, yes, I got verbal permission to sign the documents because we were hitting a deadline and it was urgent, so I forged the three signatures. Okay, well now we have evidence. We have two statements by the complainer and complainee, right? And so now what? And we have a specificity now of specific actions, not just Brian's a bonehead, right?
Well, verbal is not as strong as written.
Therefore,
you cannot prove, unless the customer would assert that they gave verbal permission. This is the whole case. Is the customer going to verify that Brian received verbal permission?
Right.
If Brian received verbal permission, it could be, I mean, it's maybe a little far stretch, but it could be okay.
Right. There are a few incidents where you can actually forge someone else's name legitimately, and I'm truly stretching to find one. Brian may have been able to sign his own name with an annotation, received verbal permission from person A, B, and C, date and time, and submitted it that way. And if they accepted it, that's on them. That would have been the honest thing to do, but this is probable action is forgery. PCI DSS documentation, that's some pretty serious stuff to present forgery on, right? And that protects perhaps millions and millions of dollars. So he should have recorded the verbal approval and asked for written writing. Could you take time enough to send me an email or a text, something? Could I get a FaceTime or some other sort of WebEx, whatever, and record it, and you telling me to sign on your behalf? There are all sorts of ways that Brian could have taken action besides forging signatures. I think this is actionable and unethical and perhaps even illegal. I think now we have a case. This is now actionable.
Well, and I would further question his judgment too. I mean, the thought that in any circumstance it would be okay to forge a customer signature tells me his judgment's a little off.
Yeah. Or certainly acting outside his competence, right? Yeah. I am a guardian of somebody through the courts, and I get to sign my name, guardian for other person, right? Or sign my name, president of this association, right? And sometimes it asks for president, and I was the treasurer. So I signed that I'm the treasurer. And if you'll accept that, okay, that's on you, that's not on me, but I don't write a different name. this is pretty bad. And again, these are based on pretty well real cases. So,
Lisa has a question. Could you do a digital signature on three signatures? Probably not, right? I mean, how could you forge three signatures digitally? That would be very fraudulent.
If you have a process that provides for chain of evidence, such as a DocuSign, Adobe also has. There are secure digital signature methodologies that would permit that. And we drafted this case a few years ago, and those are much more widespread in the last 5 years than they were really even 5-6 years ago. They've come a long way in the very recent past. 10 years ago when we were crafting some of these and we pulled out of the archives, that really wasn't around. But certainly wet signature of somebody else, pretty bad. Case study, any other, would witness testimony be acceptable from the people that gave the verbal okay under oath? Well, certainly that could be, and that might get them out of hot water in the courts if there were a criminal case. Would that be accepted by the IAC squared conjecture? Don't know. Certainly if that is the case and there were was the thought that, And especially if there had been an annotation, right? It wouldn't take much to twist that case study where it would probably been okay. But actually forging the signature, not cool. So this is unfortunate, really. that somebody would have this kind of an error. Let's talk about Cindy. Cindy's a student in a CSSLP curriculum, and she is caught by campus security having compromised the security of some of her school's servers. And now the school states it's without notice or permission. Oh, she says she's conducting a penetration test for the school project on network security, and she has documents showing her plans, but she has no documents providing permission. So is this ethical?
No.
No.
Please. Tina, come on.
Yeah, Tina, come on.
I was shaking my head. Sorry.
Yes. Is it legal?
No.
Well,
you need written permission. It's not illegal.
But where did it happen? Not every country has laws against this, but certainly is it against the code of ethics, and almost certainly against school policies and the honor code. I mean, I think they could find something to stand this on. Certainly a violation of the code of ethics, and it's actionable with evidence because she admitted it. I didn't think, here's my documents, but I can't provide anything else. Well, so a little, let's see if Cindy, we sent her a letter, let's see what she comes back with, and she provides documents from her teacher. Okay, she has her teacher that said they were to have arranged for a scope of effort document and a permission letter from the school. But she got impatient. And so, you know, she had a schedule to keep. She started her scan as scheduled and did not wait for the letter and permission. Does this change the case?
No.
No?
Not to me.
No. No. Nearly had it.
It's not written.
Yeah, now it depending on the country and, you know, the passion of the judge, et cetera, and compassion, I should say. You know, if it actually was just in the mail, maybe, but wow, no, Cindy.
I can't believe that. I can't even believe an instructor would have the authority to give permission for that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and
other students' data at risk, they can't authorize one student to break into the school system with all the other school students' data. I mean,
yeah.
An instructor would be fired for doing that too.
Probably. Almost certainly, you know, and maybe very optimistic that such permission would be forthcoming when, of course, we would go, really? I think that breaks a few laws. I think this is actionable with evidence and bad judgment on her part. Bad move. Let's talk about Daryl. Daryl's a CISSP, and he has self-published a general security book. Emily files a complaint, says, Daryl ripped off 12 pages verbatim from a book she had published 2 years prior. And Emily shows that the text contained no attribution. So clear case of plagiarism. Is plagiarism against the code of ethics?
Yes.
Yes.
I believe you'd say it would be. It's not acting honorably, not acting justly. And certainly it is harming a colleague and the profession and perhaps even society. Right? Because the purchasers of the book are not getting what they believe they are. So there's a sliver of fraud. But remember, way back in the day, people were prosecuted for stealing fractional cents of electricity. So, you know, fractional cents of devaluation of a book would probably be a real thing by the courts. So this is certainly harms the profession and a colleague. But Gerald responds, hey, wait a minute, hang on. The text said attribution as an endnote. And was listed in the foreword of the book and in the bibliography. So it was an endnote, not a footnote. So was Daryl cleared?
Probably.
I had this one flagged as it depends.
Don't
I know, 12 pages is a lot. That's not a paragraph. 12 pages is a photocopy job to me, right? That's I'm gonna like build, you know, a good chunk of a chapter. So
yeah, the end note would have been okay if he had paraphrased or summarized the information.
Or had permission from the author. Yeah. Permission from the author would have been great. Obviously, Emily doesn't think so. She's a bit surprised. Hard to say if it's actual fair use. This is getting into legalities and jurisdiction. And this is one of the other challenges of the ISC squared is you can't play world cop and only go after somebody where it's illegal everywhere. Or the opposite, if it is legal anywhere. You can't play that. You have to look at, is this person violating the ethics in the country they are in? And the classic cases we would discuss, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, is that it is a felony to smuggle gum into Singapore. And now a felony for a single cigarette. And would you want to take action against somebody for chewing gum? Well, it is against the law in Singapore. Now, that was a ridiculous example, but obviously you have countries where you have drug use and prostitution and all sorts of differences in laws. And I can tell you, I know far more about the age of consent than I ever wanted to know. And it is as low as 12 in Nigeria and as high as, I think, 23 if you're a woman in, I think, Malaysia. So you can't say we're to go by this rough standard, it's the country they're in. So is 12 pages more than fair use in that jurisdiction? I would think this is an unethical act, and I would think it's actionable. And I'm glad I wouldn't have to be the only person to decide this without asking colleagues to weigh and sift this and gain some counsel on this. But 12 pages does seem quite excessive.
It may be a more legal than ethical case.
Yeah, I think so. Usually it starts to fall down past a paragraph. Right. And that doesn't mean you jam everything together with no paragraphs, like, you know, On the Road, that famous novel had no punctuation. No, that's cheating. So 12 pages is a bit crazy. So let's talk about Frank. I didn't see any questions pop in. So I'll quote people say, yeah, 12 pages. That's a lot. Yeah. So Frank is a CISSP who has conducted a certification and accreditation assessment. So that's if you're not familiar with those two terms, certification is, you can think of that as fit for use by somebody who has assured it has standards of sufficiency and quality. The example I think of this is UL listed. If you look on the bottom of toasters, it says, you know, it's UL listed, but you don't use it in the shower or the pool and other places, right? It's for toast. And then you have accreditation, that's authorization. You can think of that as based on the certification. It could be launched, published to production, made official, et cetera, just as Purdue is authorized to offer bachelor degrees in chemistry based on the evidence and standards of the accreditation authority. So certification and accreditation is a more formal system where a security pro or analyst auditor will determine, is this meet our standards and certify it as sufficient according to the standards of the organization. And then accreditation would be somebody who would look at that, all the documentation, because it isn't always clean, right? Like, you know, maybe a few things, like that whole, you know, don't use the toaster in the shower thing, right? And then the signature then saying, yes, I agree, as an officer of the firm, that I will sign off and let this go into production. That's the certification accreditation process to frame this up. So this is a system that provides online access to view and manage consumer investments. And Frank has documented 40 high-risk issues. So didn't skate clean. Certification has some high-risk issues there, in fact, 40. So after completion and sign-up on the certification report, Martin, he's a certifier and a CISSP, modifies the document, makes it look a little glossier, right? And moves quite a few of the high risk issues to be resolved and changes the findings. And Martin submits the modified version to his superiors and the project sponsors. And this is used for an accreditation sign off. Okay.
So this is a case that I would be fairly familiar with. I mean, number one, you don't talk about certification and accreditation, it's now ANA, authorization and accreditation, yes. Which has changed. The question is Martin up the chain or is he lateral? If he's up the chain, And he updates the signature or bypasses the signature from Frank, it is completely okay, as long as he has something to justify it. The right. question is, does he have the authority to bypass Frank's comments?
Yeah, and this is modifying it without permission or notice, and submitting the modified version. So changing the findings against the other certifiers who had the findings. Remember, because Frank had the high risk issues and is a certifier. Martin is also a certifier and is saying he took Frank's high risk issues out.
Well, it's very possible if an issue gets mitigated in the meantime that a finding get, you know, for example, the what Frank did could be rejected mm-hmm. when it's presented for certification. Mm-hmm. Someone goes and fixes an issue and then updates the report and marks everything as resolved. The question is, what's Martin's role in relationship to Frank? If yeah. Martin, depending on Martin's role, it's completely okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I do know the case on which this one is based, and those things were not true. This was sneaky. So I believe that this would be cause for action. These are changing of audit findings over a long weekend. And suddenly the report looks, you know, sweet as a rose, instead of rather stinky. And then Frank takes both the original and change documents to the InfoSec VP, who's a CISSP, and says, hey, this is unethical, this is uncool. And they don't want to make waves, and the issue goes unchallenged. And Frank takes the issue up to the Ethics and Compliance Hotline, and they decline to take up the case because it's not concerning customer data, which, if you look at the case study, it absolutely is customer data. But Frank has signed an NDA, and the audit results are classified as company confidential. What should Frank do? This is a toughie, right?
I would get it in writing from somebody like Martin. I mean, if Martin is above him, I mean, because my problem is it's going to come back to Frank when the stuff hits the fan for the company mm-hmm. because of the lack of warning about all of the risks to the system, then it comes back to the original auditor.
Yeah.
And so I, as Frank, am now trying to find a way to cover my butt because yeah. I'm going to be the one on the hook.
That's why I say that audit reports should always be an 11 by 17 paper, because if you're trying to cover your butt, you want it on big paper. So, never mind. Frank might get thrown under the bus. Maybe Martin, right?
Frank will lose his job. If Frank does anything, he's out of a job and probably not employable for the rest of his life.
Yeah, possibly. You know, something this big, and you know, this would probably only be found out in an audit where they would go, well, that's funny. I'm finding a lot of things. Let me pull out the initial report. Oh, that's funny. That's on the report. What happened? Right? It's showing resolved. Let me ask the question: Does Frank have the authority to bring this before the ethics committee?
Yes, but there's going to be a payout that he's going to be without a job for the rest of his life. So the smart thing to do is keep your mouth shut. Let it go.
Yeah, this is the hard one.
It's not the right answer, but it's the one that saves your butt.
Yeah, I did discuss this exact case with the ethics committee for a long time, and they ultimately believe that Frank was not compelled to act as a whistleblower. And in fact, Frank would be violating ethics to then break their NDA and divulge company confidential information, even though it was, for disclosing an unethical act, that they were essentially bound by the NDA and could not act. I think this changes if it was a life system. And as well too, you know, you have to understand, you know, how bad are the findings actually? How much money is at play? I mean, who could actually be harmed? There are all sorts of things that have to be weighed and sifted in something like this. Could somebody die is a big question. But this was very hard. And unfortunately, this kind of thing does happen in the real world, that audit findings are falsified.
I think his best option is to leave voluntarily. Yeah. I mean, if he's, like Laurent says, you know, he's going to be retaliated against for doing the right thing. It's not a company I want to work for anyway.
Yeah, I have twice left organizations based on ethics issues where I'd say I'm sorry, I'm out. And that's one of the things that a professional does is if you're being asked to do unethical things, or you're seeing unethical acts and you need to disassociate yourself, and that's hard. But I didn't lose any sleep doing it. Lost sleep at the time, but do not regret that.
I had the same situation. I actually had, I got into a lot of trouble with one company that was extremely unethical, doing something that was borderline illegal. But, you know, filing ethical complaints would have made me,
make you a pariah, right? Yeah. Bring it and, you know, makes the papers. And you know, your organization probably also has, you know, you essentially have disclosed and, you know, there now is whistleblower law that would protect you if there's a federal contract in place, but that may or may not have been the case. So yeah, that was a very sticky one. I threw that tough one in here. So let's wrap it up with perhaps the granddaddy here. I hope you appreciate this one. And I did get permission from the person this happened to. This is not an authorized case of the IAC Squared Ethics Committee, but has appropriately been obfuscated and vetted to ensure that it does not disclose the innocent or perhaps the guilty, and make sure that this is a clean one to share. So this is a little chewy, but Kylie is CISSP and CSSLP. She's an independent consultant. She's hired by an incident response firm, and they're performing incident response at a hospital investigating a major incident by an apparent nation state attacker, right? And situation's chaos. Things are going crazy. Dozens of servers compromised, 50 exhausted staff engaging in finding the bad guys and restoring control. And when you have dozens of servers compromised, that's a bad day. So the client's on fire. They desperately need help. And so she's parachuted in to bring order to the chaos, but she's not asked to sign any contract or NDA, essentially operating off a handshake agreement. She's uncomfortable and notes this lapse to the firm who's hired her and to their legal counsel, and is told that we'll get you an NDA. And she reminds them several times, doesn't get it, but she feels she's met her obligation. She's still does not have an actual contract. And she asked multiple times for protection of the investigation or attorney work product or attorney client privilege. She's not an attorney, so she cannot operate in that regard, but recognizes the lack of protection. And the organizational lawyers declined to invoke legal protection under attorney work product or attorney client privilege. So what are the obligations of Kylie in this case? She's in kind of a bad spot. Should she professionally exit the engagement until a relationship and obligations are formalized?
What's the prime here in this case?
Pardon?
What's the prime? I mean, there's no prime here. There's a number of facts. There is no prime.
No, I can't. The one word you're not saying, I can't understand.
What is the issue here?
The issue is she does not, she's not covered by NDA, does not have a formal contract for her actions. So she doesn't have a formal statement authorizing her to operate. In essence, not completely different from the prior case, whose name I don't remember in the case study, who was scanning her school. No formal documentation for an arrangement.
So there was the first line states that she was engaged as an independent consultant hired by an incident response firm. So this establishes a relationship, and she should be covered by this relationship with the incident response firm.
Yeah, she's not in a great place, but this probably isn't unethical. She's, you know, a handshake agreement actually is a thing, right? It's harder to prove exactly what happened. Hopefully there are witnesses. She's in a bad spot, but doesn't have an ethical obligation here. I think she has fulfilled what is necessary and is raising alarm, not to be alarmist, but has concerns she's raising, and they say, don't worry. Okay. And you know, she has taken the coin and bread of the king, as the saying goes, right? And is doing work. Okay, so let's see what happens here. And the investigation proceeds. There's some skilled forensic investigators and threat analysts. They're not hacks. They're good folks, qualified. And that the geolocation data and indications of compromise, the attack methodologies, can be attributed to high probability to be agents from the Isle of Nabumbu. So actually, which is from Bedknobs and Broomsticks. I don't think it's actually the Isle of Nabumbu. But they do recognize that these are actually nation state agents, and they've actually identified the target. And they're further able to determine that unauthorized access has been achieved to the electronic medical record server, and an exploit was used that provided root level access. And they validated, we can see the compromise matched the vulnerability permitting the exploit. And it was at that moment the server stopped processing log events. And thousands of encrypted packets are flying back and forth from the attackers and the EMR, but no logging. And they're on their 90 minutes with packets going off. And then the attackers proceed to directly target and compromise a physician's PC, apparently downloading the synchronized corporate email data from that PC. The physician reports they have a high profile political patient, King Kangaroo of Oceania, who is a known stated enemy of the Isle of Nabumbu, and there were prior assassination attempts. Organizational management decides that as there is no proof that medical data was compromised, that there will be no breach notification as required by law. Kylie believes this breaks the law. But again, she's not a lawyer, but she thinks this probably is a breach. And there will be no notification of law enforcement, national security government officials, or Oceania. All right, so what are Kylie's obligations? Kylie's in a bigger pickle now, isn't she?
Yes.
No,
yeah. This starts getting interesting.
Yeah. And we don't know in what locality, so you know that's obfuscated where this actually occurred, but breach notification is required by law according to her information.
Yes.
And we have medical data compromised. So this is potential for human beings to be harmed. This is not just data being breached and a privacy issue. This is perhaps people being harmed. And then if she believes his attack endangers King Kangaroo, because she knows there were prior assassination attempts, does that change her obligation if she believes that attack is, which appears to be targeting, don't know, but there's a lot of smoke here to be no fire.
Well, if it was me in this person's shoes, since there was no, as you said, contract or NDA, I would not file an ethical complaint for fear of losing my life over this for filing a complaint, but I would go to the FBI and report this as an event. Probably would go with InfraGuard or FBI someone and raise this as an issue, but not do it as an ISC Square ethical thing, because this could have life and death consequences on the person.
Yeah. And I have been engaged in ethical situations that could have caused harm. And
I think that's what it costs a lot, right?
That raises the bar big time, because there is no cost higher than the cost of human life. Cannot do any math higher than a single soul, right? So that is A number one. And this is somebody potentially being harmed.
Yeah.
This is a hard one, right? But these are kinds of real things that, that information security professionals sometimes have to consider. All right. Any additional questions? I don't know, Tina and Lauren, if we have time for the bonus slide or not. I think we're right up against time. So
no, go for it. I want them to see that.
All right. So I have a bonus slide, and this is sharing of myself, not necessarily about information security. And this is the number one diagram that I share with students and interns. Basically, you know, and I know we have some older students here, seasoned. But you know, basically, if you're under 30, I share this information with you because I wish somebody had shown it to me. As you go through life, you have to find where it is that you have talent. You know, I shared with you some of my passions. I love motorcycling. I do not to excess, but I do enjoy a good glass of bourbon every once in a while. Used to enjoy golf until I found motorcycling. And on a Sunday afternoon, that's nice. I tend to hop on the Harley instead. But nobody's willing to have me pay for that. So I'm up in this sector with my Harley riding of just talent. Oh, and joy. I can find talent and joy from that. I enjoy it. I'm good at it. If I can also find something that somebody's willing to pay me for. So we're talking Tiger Woods level of golf here, right? There's money involved. There's talent. There's joy. We found an intersection. And I had this moment where I was working for BMW Financial. Great company. Love the company. And I was talented at what I was doing. I enjoyed what I was doing. There was, it was this really intellectual curiosity, great company to work for. I was being paid good money. But I woke up to the fact that putting Beamers in people's driveways is so far from feeding starving children in the world. And it didn't match this bottom quadrant circle, which is what I call peace. Whatever it is that you would say is your mission. And we all have a different sense of what that mission is. Right. I've worked for Nationwide Insurance. And when hurricanes go through and there's devastation, they show up with water and diapers and power and checks and put communities back together. That was pretty cool. So I had talent, I had joy, I had treasure, I had peace. And now I'm in this middle. And that is a beautiful place to be. So evaluate every 5-6 years. I pull. Look at my resume. It's the study the belly button question of where am I? Am I still executing where I find joy, where I have talent? You know, the pay is pretty easy to figure out whether or not that's working. And am I at peace with where I am? Am I at peace with my mission and alignment of what I'm doing in the daytime and my mission in this world? And that may cause you actually to find more joy by kind of diminishing that treasure circle and taking a job that pays less, but for which you find greater joy, greater peace, and get to use your talents.
That's a very good point, Dan, because let me share something with a number of students. I make decent money. I mean, nothing fantastic and stuff. I'm often told I could go and do something people say more rewarding and more up to my level of skills. The problem is that instead of working 40 hours, I would work probably 70 hours a week. So when you pretty much doubled my work week, is the return on investment with the fact that, you know, it takes away 40 hours of my spare time worthwhile. You guys need to all to think about this. Is getting $10,000 more per year worthwhile the trouble? Many years ago in France, before I came to US, I was offered a major promotion. I was offered, I remember, $50,000 extra in salary, which was not small change at that time, to get a major promotion. And, you know, it would have more than doubled my work time. I decided it was not worth it because, you need a personal life. If you just work, you'll just be maybe successful, but you won't be much more than successful.
Yeah, and I've had this discussion with my kids. It's why I choose to live in Columbus, Ohio. It's a pretty awesome place, actually. I've gotten offers to move to all sorts of great places for big numbers, and I'm sorry, but the quality of life that I can have working downtown San Francisco when I have a family, I'm either looking at spending 3 hours a day commuting, probably minimum, or postage stamp apartment. And I have nothing against San Francisco, great place to work, wouldn't want to live there, right? I've talked to my kids. I could easily make double what I'm making, easily, no problem. I would live out of a suitcase, and you would only see me maybe 6 weekends a year, maybe 8. And I'd be that guy on the WebEx, and that would be it. And I have a friend of mine who is really pursuing high dollar. He wants to be able to work really hard for the next 10 years and put a lot in the bank so he can retire at 45 and spend time with his family. And I'm like, you mean the strangers you built for 10 years because you haven't seen your kids from the time they were 8 until they were 18? That family? Yeah. I give him those hard words and he's still doing it. Not going to name names. But I think that's somebody who's a little out of balance. Because nobody on their deathbed says, I wish I'd spent more time at work. Doesn't happen.
Right. Yeah, I can tell you, I used to live in Columbus myself. Again, Dan was the person who's responsible for helping me get my CSSP many, many years ago. And ever since I moved to Arizona, I mean, life has been great. I mean, what I discovered personally is the power of sunshine. When you move to a place where it's sunny pretty much every day, it makes things more fun. And then, you know, if you have time every day to enjoy your walk, enjoy a little time outside at the pool, or, you know, having a cocktail or whatever, it makes life worthwhile. Remember, a job is it's important, but it's not the most important thing in life.
Yeah. The worst commute I've ever had was 25 minutes.
The longest or the shortest?
The longest I ever had. I've had many that were shorter. I worked at L Brands, the parent company of Victoria's Secret, Bath & Body Works, Pink, La Senza. And I left at 10 till the hour for my interview, and I was 3 minutes early. It was that close. So a 5-minute Harley ride to work, that was pretty awesome. So that's one of the reasons I live in a tier 2 city. So I got to take 2 hops on an airplane to get almost anywhere. But life's pretty easy. So, well, we are over time. I see a lot of agreements, don't see a lot of questions. I wanted to leave you with that because ultimately, I think this is thinking that will lead you towards happiness. Let me just say that.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Dan, I send you a Gmail meeting so that we can talk afterwards about the thing that we just discussed at the beginning of the meeting. I don't have the phone number anymore for some reason. I changed phones. If you can respond so we can talk briefly, that would be wonderful.
Okay, sure. Absolutely.
So again, Dan, please allow me to thank you for this event. I think it's important for students to realize that there's many different aspects of CISSP. The ethical thing, again, don't underestimate it. There are questions in the exam. Don't think, oh, it's not IT related, it's not important. It is important, at least to pass the exam. Afterwards, yes, you need to worry about things, ethical things. But you know, again, Dan, thank you. And Dr. Burton, would you like to conclude, please?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Picard. And thank you so much, Dan. We definitely appreciated your time today. And I look forward to seeing your other presentation in the future. So we'll have you back again. We had 2 to choose from tonight, and this was awesome. So I think both of them will be great. And everybody else, thank you so much for your attendance tonight. I'll send out the recording for anyone that might have missed the beginning. And I'll send out a survey in a couple of days as well, so we can get some feedback. And I appreciate everybody's time. Have an awesome evening. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Bye, guys.